All right, welcome everyone to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. It's Thursday night, May 9th. I was about to say June 9th, but if that were the case, then it would be the night after my daughter's impending wedding here. Yeah, she's got engaged. So anyway, it is May 9th, and I am joined by one Brian Perez, the editor of the Bears Wire at USA Today. And he also does, you know, very fine work with the Chicago Bears podcast, the Chicago Shuffle, and with At the First Pick, the site expert there. You know, Brian is one of the OGs of, you know, kind of draft Twitter and really even just draft sites in terms of doing work there. And it's always a pleasure, Brian, to be able to talk with you. And today we're going to get a chance to talk about Bears draft as well as scouting in general. So welcome to the show. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me, Matt. The pleasure and really the privilege is all mine to be able to, you know, come on the air with you and just learn through meiosis or whatever, osmosis, whatever the word is. Just be able to take on some of your knowledge. You call me the OG. One of the OGs at Draft Twitter. I remember logging on to Draft Twitter and just being in awe of all of your takes. And, you know, through the years, just being able to build a relationship with you on there and then meeting up with you down in Mobile during the Senior Bowl and just building a strong friendship has been one of the real joys of this whole experience to date.
Oh, man. Well, thank you. And certainly it's likewise from my end as well. I've certainly enjoyed it. And it was funny because even though this player didn't work out, you know, I think one of the places where we really got acquainted is that we both had an affection for Kenbrell Tompkins.
Remember right. Him? Yeah, I do remember him. Absolutely. Right. It's funny how such, you know, you don't want to say players or people in general turn into insignificant, you know, NFLers or what have you. But it is funny how, especially in draft Twitter, it's one of those unique places where, you know, conversations can get sparked and then friendships and bonds can be formed over the strangest and most, at some points, insignificant, you know, points in time through life. And especially with draft Twitter, one of the really fun things about it is you can almost go through a chronology of events just by referencing certain players from certain draft classes and brings you right back to that place and time in your life. So, yeah. Just name dropping players like that, it sure does bring you back to the old school days.
It's scary and nerdy how much that is, because it's like, for me, I can think of that Kendrell Tompkins with you, with Gene Bramall. It was us trying to outdraft each other for Ray Rice way back in the day. And then before that, my good friend Mike McGregor, who we tried to build a site together and do some work together, it was trying to trade Bernard Berrien, and he pronounced it, he wrote it out in an email as Barium, B-E-R-R-I-A-M. So the joke was Bernard Barium, and that still goes on to this day. So
that's fantastic. Yeah.
So listen, you know, you do great work covering the Bears, and I thought it would be kind of fun to have this conversation with you, because, you know, I got a chance to speak with Lauren Cox recently, who does fine work and talking about the Bears offense. And I'm just curious, because you do so much work covering them, where do you think this offense is trying to go?
To be honest, the offense is trying to go wherever the heck Mitchell Trubisky is going to take it. And I think that's really the big question right now, is if Bears fans are completely honest with themselves, I would say that 2018 is still something of an incomplete grade on Trubisky in terms of figuring out exactly what kind of quarterback he's going to ultimately develop into. And I think what he has going for him is a team that has committed a lot of resources, whether it's from the coaching staff, you know, Matt Nagy is a direct result of trying to build that quarterback friendly system, a quarterback first coach, and then all the resources they've dumped into the offensive skill players dating back to last year's free agency with Allen Robinson and Taylor Gabriel and Trey Burton, drafting Anthony Miller in the second round last year, trading up for him this year, spending their first pick on David Montgomery, then Riley Ridley in the fourth round, when really wide receiver, especially when you count Javon Wims from last year's draft class as well. Wide receiver was one of the strongest positions on the depth chart going into draft weekend, and they still used one of their highest draft picks in this year's class on a receiver. So they're clearly making it all about, you know, Mitchell Trubisky. And I think what you're going to see is a pass first offense like we saw last year, which is why Jordan Howard ultimately went, you know, is out of town, shipped out via trade to the Eagles, because he is not a pass first style running back, whereas David Montgomery is a player who on first down, second down, it will be just as effective as a receiver as a runner. And I think you're just going to see a lot of what you saw in Kansas City, maybe more the Alex Smith Chiefs versus the Patrick Mahomes Chiefs. And, you know, David Montgomery, substitute him in for that Kareem Hunt role. And, you know, they don't have that Tyreek Hill necessarily on the roster, but they do have a really, really exciting group of 5-6 deep at wide receiver, where you might not have the Tyreek Hill 4-2 speed, but you're going to have fresh legs on every rep, the way they're going to be able to rotate those guys in and out of a game. So it may not be fantasy football friendly, because you might not have that alpha receiver who has 110 catches and 1,300 yards and 13 touchdowns. But as a collective group, I think you're going to see a really productive passing offense, assuming Mitchell Trubisky can kind of settle down and get his accuracy more in line with what you'd expect from, you know, a number two overall pick.
Excellent. And I want to follow up with two points to discuss when it comes to this subject. And I think the first one obviously is Trubisky. You know, when I watched him last year, there was a lot of the same stuff that he had troubles with at North Carolina in terms of just overall decision making, you know, inside the 20s, either backed up in his own area or inside the 20s. It just seemed like that there were issues with decision making, holding on to the ball too long, trying to make plays that were aggressive but turned into being reckless decisions, and areas where when once something went wrong, it seemed to compound his it kind of compounded, and he got into a little bit of quicksand at times. So and then you saw a lot more encouragement for him to be able to run, because he's such an athletic player. And that worked out pretty well, him being able to take some easy runs or even just, you know, break tackles and make people miss and get gains where that, you know, maybe other quarterbacks would have thrown the ball. What do you, in addition to what I just commented on, or if you want to touch on that or comment on something else, what do you think he needs to work on for Bears fans to see this year that they're going to be assured, you know, if he shows this in 2019, What is it that he has to show that will be more assured about his future?
Well, the first thing I would say with Trubisky that I think gets overlooked quite a bit, and it's not an excuse for him, but it is a reality of his learning curve, is the last season was only his second full season from, you know, start to finish, starting a year since basically high school. I mean, he started his senior year of college, then his rookie season, he started 12 games, and then under a different coach with a different system. And then last year, new offense, where basically Matt Nagy said it could take seasons before a quarterback really masters it, let alone one training camp. And it's only his first full season as an NFL starter. I think experience is going to actually play a big factor in Trubisky looking more confident in the pocket, not seeming as rattled as maybe he did last year when that first read is covered. You see he wants to tuck and run. I think we're going to see a little bit more composure even with when he throws the football, because last year it seemed like he was that excited kid in the playground. Open read is there, and he just puts all the juice behind the ball, and it sails off target. I think with experience, with a guy who has seen the open receiver time and time again, understands the progressions in the offense, isn't going to feel like he has to force the throw because the receivers, that first read's wide open right away, and then, you know, he puts too much fire behind his pass. I think, at least I'm expecting, that with that experience, coming into the locker room now, his second full season with Matt Nagy, that we're just going to see a more mature, confident presence in the pocket, which should turn into a more mature, confident, accurate passer, which again should turn into more production, sustained drives, more points, and a guy who could literally put this team on his shoulders, because that's what they've committed to. There is no Matt Forte. There is no Brandon Marshall, Alshon Jeffrey, not even a quote-unquote Jordan Howard. This is the Trubisky show. Start, finish, everything in between. It's all about him. And I think with experience, he's a mature guy. He's got a good head on his shoulders. He has the work ethic to succeed. and he's got the physical talent. It just comes down to now experience on the field and in the quarterback room at Matt Nagy's offense. If he doesn't take that next step this season with all of that experience under his belt, a second year in the system and a full season as a starter under his belt, then maybe there's reason to be concerned. But I'd bet on Trubisky coming through and having a really good year in 2019.
Nice. So you mentioned, you know, that they don't really have a Tyreek Hill type in this offense. And it's interesting because to me, you know, last year heading into, you know, at this time last year, I was starting to write articles about Tarik Cohen's season in John Fox's regime and how that there were a lot of parallels between how they used Cohen in certain isolated circumstances to what they were doing with Nagy was doing with Tyreek Hill. And of course, Nagy said, listen, he's not Tyreek Hill, but we're going to use him in ways that in the spirit of the way we tried to capture the versatility that Tyreek Hill has to offer, we'll try to do the same things with Cohen. And I certainly think they did a good job of using Cohen. He was used very well as a receiver and as a runner, and they could do different, they did different things to kind of keep the defense off balance. But what was fascinating to me was that the guy who used Cohen more like Hill was the previous offensive coordinator under the Fox regime, with some of these deep posts and deep seam routes. And you could see that at certain points in the middle and later in the season, but also even in the opener against Atlanta, there were some plays where they even, you know, put the, you know, Glennon even put the ball, you know, up for grabs and in a intentional way for Cohen to go up and try and get it. And I just wonder if you think about Cohen as a guy who could possibly offer that kind of role or expanded that role. Do you think the Bears will look deeper into that and see if, because at North Carolina A&T, I saw a guy who also could make plays down the field. And of course, short guys it's very difficult for quarterbacks to want to like throw the ball in a 50-50 situation. So I don't expect that. And I also don't expect that with Trubisky and the tendencies that they'd like to quell, you know, that targeting Cohen in that fashion would be counterproductive to the direction they want to go with it. But I would like to know, just in kind of what I'm talking about here with Cohen, what are your thoughts about him moving forward, especially with the drafting of Montgomery? How do you see them using him and coexisting in the backfield as well as with the other receivers?
So speaking about the Tyreek Hill, Tarik Cohen type of usage that, you know, Tyreek Hill was that zebra role with the Chiefs. And we'll speak strictly, obviously, on the football side of things, because Tyreek Hill has a lot going on off the field that is for another day and for other people to comment on. But I think what we are seeing with Matt Nagy's iteration of the Bears offense and what we will probably see in Kansas City next season, if Hill does, in fact, end up even on the roster, suspended for an extended period of time, we're going to realize just how generational Tyreek Hill is in terms of a speed player, in terms of a downfield weapon, in terms of a, you know, put the ball in his hands and the field will get flipped in one play. He's generational. I mean, I know, Matt, you've watched a heck of a lot more football than even I have, but I tend to go back a few decades here. And aside from Randy Moss, I don't think there is any player who is as potentially game-changing, field-flipping, you know, home run hitting with that type of unreal generational football field speed as Tyreek Hill. Yeah. So while Tarik Cohen is a fast dude, he's not Tyreek Hill. And you realize that you may want to use him in that way, but the difference becomes obvious once you put him in that type of role or you ask him to do the things that Tyreek Hill did. He'll do a poor man's version, but it won't be as impactful. The Bears signed Taylor Gabriel to be their Tyreek Hill. They signed him to be the zebra, the guy that's going to catch the ball and just take off. And Taylor Gabriel is a fast dude, real fast. He looks slow playing the role that Tyreek Hill played. So I think what has to happen is this Chiefs offense, the Andy Reid, Matt Nagy offense, Tyreek Hill was an anomaly for that system. And they may try to replace him with the kid they drafted from Georgia, and he might be able to do it. But I think what you're going to end up seeing with Tarik Cohen with the Bears is more of like a, I think his best fit is like a Darren Sproles role, a guy who can carry the ball 15 times and be productive if you want him to, a guy who can catch 10 passes and be productive if you want him to. Just get the ball in his hands, and as you say, let him make chicken salad out of you know what. He'll do it. And some of the plays will be a 50-yard touchdown. Some of them will be 12 yards where he had to run 50 yards to pick up those 12. But the Tyreek Hill type of generational playmaking ability, it's not a knock on Tariq Cohen. He's just not that guy. And I think the more we take Tariq Cohen and put him into the Darren Sproles bucket, the more successful he would be with the Bears.
Well, speaking of which, in terms of Tyreek Hill, you know, I would say that if the Chiefs have been pretty loose and risk embracing about how they scout players in terms of their off field, I've always had the impression that the Bears are a conservative team in terms of scouting off field and character. And I was wondering if you could share your thoughts as someone who's covered them for a while on whether that you agree that's a philosophy of theirs. And anything else that you've noticed about how the Bears scout talent, what they're looking for, what they value?
So if I could say that there's a trend or a prototype or a trait that Ryan Pace tends to, you know, be drawn to, it's character with a little bit of an asterisk. It's not character necessarily as we would probably define it, like moral character. It's more football character. It's a guy who lives and breathes and eats the game. It's a guy who, like, for example, you read the stories about David Montgomery after a loss, 11 o'clock at night, he's at the facility lifting weights and watching film and calling his coach for pass codes to get into the facility because he can't get the game off of his mind. It's guys with a high football IQ. You'll hear Ryan Pace say that over and over again in post-draft or pre-draft press conferences, that he wants guys with a high football IQ. And guys who love the game and who have a high football IQ don't always have a perfectly squeaky clean background. But generally speaking, if you're working hard at your craft and you're committed to your craft, you're probably a decent guy. And those two things tend to go hand in hand. There are anomalies from time to time, and not every decision is going to be perfect. But I think Ryan Pace likes the players who literally dedicate their entire lives to the game. And you could see that with guys like Roquan Smith last year, David Montgomery this year, you know, Mitchell Trubisky, the work ethic, the character, the football character that he brings to the locker room. You could just see that those are the types of players that Ryan Pace likes, and he'll find them anywhere. I mean, he's not afraid about going small school. Bilal Nichols last year, Tariq Cohen, we just talked about. He will take those small school guys, and he'll even take guys that have an injury history, like Eddie Jackson, for example. He's not going to shy away from other issues that maybe general managers for other organizations would look at as a negative, like level of competition, for example. Because if you're a good football player and you have that tie-breaking quality, which is you want it more than the next guy, it doesn't matter if you're from the University of Delaware or you're from Alabama. If you want it and you have the athletic ability, you have a chance to succeed. It's the guys who come into the league that maybe have been five-star guys that didn't develop that want to or that have to survive, and they didn't develop that love for the game. Those are the guys that we see, Matt, year in, year out, they'll wash out of the league. So I think Ryan Pace does a good job identifying the guys that really want the game, want to be successful. And it's been translating to success with his draft classes over the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an excellent point overall about scouting, because certainly the media scouting that I do and that so many other people do that's kind of more independent, you're not going to get that great access and ability to determine character, to determine drive, to determine the personality fit, to determine the professionalism of the player. You're going to have to try and gather that as much as you can from what you can see on the football field. And that's limited. But it makes so much sense, because I think people don't understand that, you know, in the college game, when they talk about 4- and 5-star athletes, really what that comes down to, for me, in my opinion, isn't that they're unbelievably skilled. They're unbelievably athletic, and they're more developed than most at the high school level, more than anything. To me, that's what I see when I see most 4- and 5-star guys. Certainly there are guys who are who get that those kinds of marks and acclaim who do have some advanced skills, and they turn out to be some of the better players. But there are plenty of guys who really, they lean on their athletic ability, and teams will take advantage of that because, listen, you know, in the college game, you have, you know, you might have certain, you only have a certain number of hours that you can practice per NCAA regulations. And you also are monitored throughout the day in terms of whether you're going to school, whether you're going to the tutors, you know, whether you're eating, when you're going to sleep, all that kind of stuff. And there's only so much time to work, you know, and if you do, you're putting in way extra effort. And a lot of these guys really, they're participating in schemes that are constructed in such a way and executed in such a way where it's more about showcasing their dominant athletic ability. And it's easy for those players to get enabled with that. I mean, like I think of Jake of Locke, you know, Jake Locke. What did I just say, Jake? The kid from Denver, who's now at Denver, Missouri, Drew Locke. Yeah. I don't know. I keep wanting to say Jake Locker, and a lot of people would be upset about that. But
it's but a pretty good comp, actually.
Yeah, right. See, there you go. But Drew Locke to me is a light switch player and not a thermostat player. And that's not a compliment to him. But I also don't think it's his fault necessarily in a way where you'd say, oh, he's a bad guy. He doesn't try hard enough. He doesn't, he doesn't work hard enough. I look at it as more that he was that highly recruited player. He has a big arm. He could win on the basis of that base accuracy and arm strength to work off script as well as on script, but in ways where maybe he didn't refine his game enough, and he didn't have to because they played winning football. And when he did face top teams, he didn't always, he couldn't just switch on all of the technique and things that he needed to be working on and do it perfectly in a way that Denver will expect him to develop into. But I think at the same time, you know, coaches don't have time. There's only so many priorities. So if he's getting the job done, they may say to him in the film room, yeah, you're going to have to work on that. This is something you're going to have to work on. But if they're not saying you have to work on this, right now, or you're not going to have a job, you know, that's you prioritize, you know, as a player, you're going to prioritize what's important to you, unless you're seeing far ahead, like a Peyton Manning, who has a dad for a former NFL quarterback for a dad, and you're working with other coaches as well, and you're looking two steps ahead to when you're going to be a starter in the NFL.
And you know, here's the other thing with that, Matt. And I think this is, you know, this is generally speaking the way I view, I usually don't even look back at what was the prospect ranking for these college kids coming into the NFL, 5-star, 1-star. I really don't care, because bigger, stronger, faster, right? If you're the biggest, the strongest, or the fastest, that wins on the high school level. Bigger, yep. Stronger, faster will win on the college level. When you get to the NFL, everybody's big, everybody's strong, everybody's fast. They're the biggest, the strongest, and the fastest. That's not what's going to win in the NFL anymore. What's going to win in the NFL is the guy who works as a professional and is able to identify what will give him the edge in a specific matchup, in a specific game. It's not even just necessarily building a specific edge as a route runner. It's being able to study the defensive back that you're going up against in a particular game, and what's the edge you're going to have as a route runner in that game, because your pro career is rep to rep, quarter to quarter, week to week. And if you're not working with that mentality that every single week is a new challenge for your career, and you have to find the edge to beat the guy who's just as big, just as strong, just as fast, you're going to wash out of the league. Guys like Larry Fitzgerald, he's not relying on his size and his speed and his strength. That's not what makes Larry Fitzgerald win. Larry Fitzgerald wins because he's the consummate professional who's been working every single day to understand how to beat his opponent since he was a rookie. Peyton Manning is the ultimate example, like you just said. Peyton Manning can probably start a game in his sleep, but Peyton Manning treats every single game like a masterclass. And those are the guys that ultimately are the players you want. And how do you find that guy? you only find that guy outside of the media scouting realm, obviously, if you're talking to coaches and you try to get a good grip on what is their study habits like, what is their film, what are their film room habits like, even going to class, how serious do they take their responsibilities in life in general, because it does translate to professionalism. And we can talk about traits all day long. On draft Twitter, you know, all it is, you know, clips of a guy running a route or talking about how fast or explosive a guy is. And that's fun banter and everything. But that's not what makes a guy a good pro football player.
Yeah.
All these guys can do it. All of them. They can all do it. Which guy is going to work hardest when nobody's watching? The guys that work hardest when nobody's watching are the guys that make it in the league.
Yes, absolutely. And it's funny because what you just talked about with the whole traits aspect is, yeah, I mean, people look at Larry Fitzgerald making, you know, the catch between three defenders and at Pittsburgh and making plays with people nailing him and saying, see, that's why he's a good player. But what people don't understand is that you can count on one or two hands at most those plays that he made out of a career many other plays that were
thousands of reps, thousands and thousands of reps. And when you can only take, you know, if a pro football player, when you think about a pro football player's career, like, for example, Larry Fitzgerald, we'll just stick with him. His highlight reel, if you do a career highlight reel, it might be a couple minutes long. He has thousands and thousands and hours of reps. And you're going to only be able to pull maybe a handful of minutes of truly special highlight plays that you could say, well, that's because he's a special athlete. Of course. I mean, I'm not discounting the fact that some guys like Randy Moss, for example, and a Tyreek Hill, like we just talked about, they are an anomaly. They are faster than the fastest. Some guys are bigger than the biggest, and some guys are stronger than the strongest. And those guys end up in the Hall of Fame, right? So if they have the rest of it that we were talking about. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you don't see – like let's look at the Peyton Manning draft class, 1998, when Manning came in the league.
Yeah, with Leaf.
There was a legitimate debate about which quarterback should be the number one pick. And for those of the people that are listening right now that might be a generation too young to remember that draft class, or those of us who obviously do remember it, it was not a false debate. I mean, there was legitimate reason to think Ryan Leaf could be a superstar. The difference was – the professionalism. Ryan Leaf obviously fell into some troubled parts of his life, that's all part of it, right? I mean, that's all part of this. There is no reason why Ryan Leaf shouldn't be a guy based on talent alone that's a Hall of Fame quarterback. But he was a washout because of the professionalism. That's what broke the tie between Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf.
What are things you look for on the field to give you some sense of that professionalism? Because for me, it's more about advanced concepts of putting things together in complex ways or compound ways, for instance. Because, you know, you can say, that a receiver has number of releases and that he can execute a drive step or he can catch the ball with his fingertips. But when I see players put multiple technical skills together and in various scenarios and situations that aren't always practiced, that usually tells me not only do they have an intuitive sense of the game in terms of how to combine things and react to stimuli, but it's also about they've had to have drilled that stuff enough to be able for it to even be second nature enough that they could think about it or react to it as fast as they did without overthinking it and being slow. What are some things for you that you look at where you would say, hey, that to me may lead me on the track to think that this is a guy who's a worker?
Yeah, so once you get through, I guess, that baseline evaluation of traits, because you do have to look for a basic skill set of NFL level positional traits, like route running, like vision for a running back, like accuracy and velocity and all that stuff with the quarterback. I look at energy, hustle. Is a player playing from snap to whistle? Is a running back refusing to go down on first contact? Is he not going out of bounds? Is he getting the extra yard? Is he fighting for every inch on the field? defensive linemen, even if they're out of the play, even if the play is across the other side of the field from them, are they still running at full capacity, 100%? Offensive linemen, you know, offensive linemen is one of the funnest positions for me to study, because really, an offensive lineman, especially when they're engaged with their opponent, it becomes just a one-on-one man versus man match, no matter what's going on around them. I want to see the offensive lineman take pride in burying a guy into the field. If they're just, you know, popping on contact and then kind of loafing, not sustaining their blocks, for example, and not wanting to destroy their opponent's will, the psychology of the player, those little tidbits of information, I think, can help you understand a guy that cares more about the game. You could have a defensive edge, an edge player or a defensive end, outside linebacker, who off the snap of the ball, they got that juice and they beat the offensive tackle and they might make that highlight reel strip sack once or twice even in a game. But what are they doing on the other reps where maybe they didn't win off the snap of the ball, or maybe the ball's run away from them? Are they still giving 100% effort? That snap to whistle player, I think, is a tell. It's a clue in terms of what is this player doing during the week. Are they giving it 100% effort? If they're not giving it 100% effort from snap to whistle, if an offensive lineman is falling off his blocks, not sustaining his blocks, and burying the defensive lineman into the ground, if the running back's running out of bounds, going down on first contact, not struggling for the extra 6 inches on a run, are they putting the extra 20 minutes in the film room? Are they getting the extra rep out on the bench press? I think that psychology, that psychological clue, you can take a little bit more about the player, especially in the media, when we don't get a chance to talk to these guys more often than not. And when you do talk to them, it's scripted, rehearsed information that they're just regurgitating to. You don't really see, you don't get the peek behind the curtain, for lack of a better term. On the field, everything's exposed. And a guy that loafs, a guy that doesn't give 100% effort, a guy that doesn't want to dominate every rep, I think you can get a little bit of an indication that they might not work harder than the guy who doesn't look as athletic or maybe even as talented, but I'll be damned, they're going to play until a referee tells them to stop playing. That's the guy, I think, that sticks around in the NFL longer.
So, Brian, you have a legal background. You're familiar with agents. Where do agents influence the draft process with picks? You know, both the highly regarded guys and the lesser regarded prospects who are maybe not as well known.
You know, it's a great question, and I do have friends and even family that are agents, and I think what I don't want to do is discount the value of an agent, because agents are extremely important for one primary reason, in my opinion, and that is to make sure that a player who trusts them receive proper counsel and guidance in decision-making for their career. What an agent is not going to do, in my opinion, is create an opportunity for a player that the player hasn't already created for themselves. Now, these players have been playing football since, in many, many instances, since they were elementary school kids, and at least high school kids. And they've been putting their blood, sweat, and tears into this process from the time they were young. For an agent to suggest that they are the one who will create an opportunity for a guy who sacrificed their social lives, maybe family relationships, maybe relationships with a significant other, and dedicated their life to their craft to become as great as they are, to suggest some agent coming in at the end of a junior, redshirt, sophomore, senior season is suddenly going to create that opportunity, it's complete and utter nonsense. But the agent does have an extremely important role in making sure the prospect has proper guidance, does not get caught up in taking unnecessary loans or handouts and suddenly starting their career in debt before they even sign their first contract, making sure that player is trusting the right people to train them for their pre-draft training, putting them in the right situation to maximize athletic times and tests at the combine or pro day, putting them in a right facility where they can maximize their athleticism. But when it comes to marketing a player, it's kind of like a real estate agent, right, Matt? I mean, a real estate agent has a house. They have a property that they've been trusted to list. And that real estate agent's going to do whatever they can to put that house in the curb appeal. They're going to make sure it's staged on the inside so that when potential buyers come through, they see a nice move-in condition home. That's basically putting a player in a training facility, making sure their 40 time is where it needs to be, making sure they're prepared for private interviews and whatnot. But at the end of the day, you need a buyer. The house is going to be what sells itself. The buyer is going to come into the neighborhood, and they're either going to want to live in that neighborhood and live in that house, or they're not. A real estate agent is not going to force a buyer to sign a mortgage note and suddenly take on that commitment. What's going to end up happening is the buyer is going to be the one who says, this is my house. This is the house I want to live in. This is the quote unquote player I want to invest in. And it doesn't matter if the real estate agent is standing at the front door or not. It doesn't matter if the NFL agent is standing there with the player or not. If there's a team, a general manager that wants to invest in that player, they're going to do it. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Rashawn Gary didn't have an agent, and he went 12th overall because Rashawn Gary was a blue chip prospect that whether he had an agent or not was going to go in the top 15 picks. So at the end of the day, the role of the agent is important for the person, the player, the prospect's family, to make sure in this world of chaos that is professional football, where there's a lot of sleaze and slime everywhere, that the player is protected and guided properly. There's absolutely no way whatsoever, in my opinion, that the agent is going to suddenly turn a kid from a fourth round pick into a first round pick. It just doesn't happen.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm taking the way that you describe sleaze and slime really to be about how players can be exploited on a variety of levels, not only just from agents, but also from people with business interests, people who their own families. I think people get the mistaken idea that when they hear, people with their own families, they think they have a mental picture of what that looks like. And that mental picture is the poor black kid who came from a broken family environment where people weren't around in his life, and suddenly they show up, or they're barely there for him, and now that he's starting to have success, they show up with their hand out trying to guilt him into doing things or having friends that maybe he leaned on to keep him safe and that who he felt safe around in general, but they may not be able to work with him and travel with him and be able to grow with him on a level that he did. And now they're asking for things that's going to get him into trouble. Now, certainly we've seen stories like that, and there are examples like that. But there's also the white kid who came from a middle-class home who had, who had everything that he could want and realistic expectation as far as being a kid, where parents take advantage of that or family members take advantage of that too, or they're asked to be, or they're offered business interests. I mean, Mark Brunell doesn't strike me as someone who came from the stereotypical environment that I described earlier. And he was someone that bad business deal after bad business deal, he was playing late into his career in a massive amount of debt because he had to keep playing to be able to pay for that. So, I mean, to me, football, this is another avenue where football is and sport can be very much like performance arts in our society, whether it's acting or music, where the money's fast, the money comes very suddenly. It often comes in large sums after years and years of sacrifice and work. And even then the money may not be nearly as much as what it could be considering, how much money is actually being made. For the overall larger business as a whole, but it's one of those situations where you see fame, you see fast living, and you see that very much advertised on the surface, and it's even advertised as part of the marketing plan, if you ask me, from the NFL on the level of just showing off fame and fortune and glitz and this whole American dream celebration in an over-the-top fashion, when there are a lot more players in the league who, while they're making good money, live a much more ham and eggs existence than we realize.
Absolutely. And to kind of touch back on what you said in terms of, bad business decisions and whatnot, one of the trends right now in terms of the draft prospects and when agents are recruiting them, is these kids literally start their careers in debt, and they get what's called a marketing advance, where some agents will kind of tap dance around basically inducing a player to sign for monetary gain, and they'll give what is the equivalent of a loan against whatever the first marketing deal will be that a player signs for. And believe it or not, this extends into guys that are probably even late day three or even undrafted free agents, where they'll get a check upon signing with an agency that is essentially a loan to front their cost of living and otherwise. It could even turn into a car. For the time that they're training for the draft, up to draft weekend, they sign with the team. And depending on how much that marketing advance was, this kid's first paycheck, two paychecks, three paychecks might already be gone because they now owe that back money that is obviously going to be spent probably 10 times over by the time they get to the league and they start in debt. Now, do they have the family structure to advise them against signing with an agency or whomever that's offering that type of enticing fool's gold to sign with a specific agent because you're going to get a check for $50,000, $75,000, $100,000 just to sign? Is there that strong family environment to say you don't do that? Don't start off in debt. That's bad business. That's a player by player thing, and it does not necessarily. It's not limited to socioeconomic background, race, environment. You know, it's just ego. And here's the problem. You have players, you have players who their whole lives, they've been told they're the best at every level, peewee, high school, college, they're the best. It doesn't matter if they're a Division III kid, FBS kid, anywhere in between, you're the best. More often than not, if you're an NFL prospect, you are, if not the best, one of the two or three best players on your team, in your conference, and you assume, there's this assumption that the player should be courted like a high draft pick. There are players who have unrealistic expectations, unreasonable expectations of where they rank in a particular draft class. And as a result, they want to be treated like a high round pick. So when you have an agent who might be desperate, who comes to this kid, who's going to be an undrafted free agent, maybe even just a rookie minicamp invitation, and they treat that kid like he's a first round pick with these inducements to sign and these marketing deals and everything else that puts this kid into debt, reality doesn't hit until that phone doesn't ring on draft weekend or after the draft. There's no priority contract offered. And suddenly there's this note that you got to pay back. And other guys, I mean, you could have a first round pick who takes a big marketing advance and maybe, you know, blows their knee out in the rookie season. Career's over in 2 years. Now, instead of being able to bank all the money that you would have had for all the blood, sweat, and tears that you went through to get to that point, you owe some guy or some agency this ridiculous sum of money simply because at the time there was this euphoric recruiting period and these guys all think they're going to have 15-year careers and be Hall of Famers. And they should think that way. I mean, that's you should think that way. But you need people in your life. These players need people in their lives that can give them the necessary and proper guidance to take a step back. Just work hard. If you put in the work and you do what's necessary and you trust the right people, the opportunity will come because the player earned it.
I think that's a great example. And let me give you one, just kind of a semi-hypothetical one. Okay. Say you have a young adult who's been a strong performer, you know, pretty much all childhood, adolescence, through, you know, early college career, 3.75 GPA, you know, leadership in terms of, school related, you know, clubs and programs, maybe does tons of community service, maybe runs the largest community service student group in his state, you know, has multiple scholarship offers to different colleges for academics, and is first, first team all state in, 2 years in a row at his craft. But meanwhile, he's going to certain camps or having certain one-on-one opportunities with professionals or former professionals. And they're saying to him, you've got some talent, but you really need to work on these things. Like, your fundamentals are not very strong here. But the program, the team that he's with is, they're showering him with praise everywhere that he goes. They're giving him awards. The people in his immediate circle are all telling him how good he is and how proud they are of him. And, but the people who actually matter, he doesn't know that they matter, because the other people who are giving him praise don't know those other people matter as much either. They've bought into that whole dream. And it's only until that individual ends up going into a competitive environment with other professionals and starts to realize that those things he should have been working on for the past 4, 5, 6 years, that he's actually behind. What he actually is a raw talent with developmental potential in a situation where raw talent isn't welcomed. He's going to have to accelerate extremely fast to be able to develop what he's done. Now, that's either going to alter his confidence dramatically and drop it, to a very low point, or he's either going to be special and be able to accelerate extremely fast, or he's going to be in denial and still think he's pretty darn good. And until somebody says to him, "You're not good enough, you can't be here anymore." Does that sound very familiar?
And I would say honestly that the guys that come from the environment that you described, the guys that come from the environment where they're told they're the best no matter what, and maybe because they're so good, let's say on a high school level, that the high school coaches are afraid to even launch criticism in their direction or feel as if it really doesn't matter, just put this guy on the field and even if he's doing everything wrong, he's still going to produce and we're going to win. There's no reason to do anything but praise that person. And if there's the family, the player, and if the family is the same mentality or state of mind where their son or their cousin or their brother or what have you can do no wrong because look at the results, you'll end up, those guys, you don't hear from very long. They wash out. And I think when you look at the players who have succeeded, and there's varying definitions of success and varying levels of success in the NFL. But I do think if you look at their backstories, I would say the majority, not every one of them, but the majority of them have that one person or that structure of individuals who at one point in their life gave them that aha moment, made that light switch go on, and got to them, were able to make an impact in their life. And it could be, again, from any background, poverty, wealth, any race or religion. Every person needs at some point, especially if you're always good at what you do, you still need that person to keep you grounded in your life and make you understand you can do better. There is no such thing as perfection, right? That word is actually very misleading, because as good as Peyton Manning, as great as Peyton Manning was, there will be someone at some point who does it better. And as great as Barry Sanders was, there will be someone at some point who does it better. Nobody thought anybody would be better than Jim Brown. Then Walter Payton came along. And nobody thought anybody would ever be better than Walter Payton. Then Barry Sanders came along. Somebody will always raise the bar a little higher than what we thought of as perfection. And if there's players who don't have that mentor, for lack of a better term, in their life at some point, on some level, I don't think they are set up for long-term, sustained, high-level success. And, sometimes it's not even about a person who gives that aha speech or that big moment or is able to ground the player. It might be the birth of the player's child, and an innocent little soul that comes into this world makes that player realize, wow, I have something bigger than me to work for now. And it actually grounds them, or whatever the case. It might be a marriage. It might be a spouse. You don't know what that moment is, but you can usually find that moment that takes the player from being just physically superior and can take them out of that world of that bubble of you're the greatest and put them into that bucket of it's time to be a pro, because there's more at stake here than just your stats. There's a lot more riding on this. And you could find those players. You see Larry Fitzgerald's relationship with his family and his mom and the backstory that he has there. I mean, there's so many examples of this. You look at the Hall of Fame speeches, right? Just watch any Hall of Fame speech and you see why these guys are Hall of Famers. Look at the people they refer to and they give credit to for their success. You never have a player go up there and say, I have no one to thank. There's no one to thank here. I did this all because I'm the greatest and, you know,
right.
That's a great bust and see you all at the after party. That's not how it works.
It's not lip service they're paying there for sure.
Exactly.
And even, you know, you talked about, you know, no one greater than Jim Brown. Well, Barry Sanders' father felt that way. And people joke about that and kind of say, oh, well, even there were people who were like, God, kind of what a hard ass of a father he was to say that to Barry Sanders. But it also grounded Barry Sanders, you know, whether it was intentional or not. It grounded him in a way to understand that there was always someone better, that he always could have work to do, that, you know, that just because he did great didn't mean that he was the greatest, you know, and when you have someone close to you who can keep things in balance, that's a good thing. By the way, the person I described was me as a musician. So, you know, in that example, that was how my music career actually kind of went. Yeah. So, and so when I see how those things kind of go down, it's interesting to me because I remember going into a school and that was a really top flight program with a lot of people I was competing with who were professionals coming off of tours that were just getting degrees so that they could, you know, they could have something bankable to teach, to be able to do work and get a paying gigs that were outside of performing music, because performing music is hard. It was fascinating to go in there. Only until I was in that environment did I see, oh, wow. Cause I remember going into it thinking, oh, I'm going to be doing this and I'm going to be doing that. And these are the things I'm going to be doing after this. And I realized on the first day that maybe my world was turned upside down. Like I literally realized, wow, okay, I have a lot to learn, you know, and I can see that dynamic happen with these players the way you described, like, because it's happened to me. I can see how it happens to them on a football field and how they respond to things and talk about things even to the media when they look back on their careers and what they were thinking heading in, and then where something hit them where they realized this is a whole different ball game than what I anticipated.
Absolutely. So, and sometimes it is just a matter of getting smacked in the face by a grown man, right? I mean, sometimes that aha moment does happen on the field. And but there is usually a turning point where a guy can shed the camouflage or disguise of, you know, I'm the biggest, I'm the best, I'm the fastest, I'm the strongest, and somebody, you know, humbles them and then it goes from there. But I really am a firm believer. I mean, in my personal life, you know, my father is my greatest, you know, source of inspiration in everything I do. And, you know, having that pillar of strength and support and being grounded and knowing, you know, there is someone there to praise you when you do well and to call you out when you're not doing as well as maybe you can do. That's so important in life. And football, as that you hear all the time, football is just a small example of the bigger picture of life. So having these guys, and this kind of brings us full circle right back to what we talked about with the Bears and their scouting department and trends. I think Ryan Pace looks for that. Do these guys have these guys had that aha moment, and do they get it?
Yeah. And I think it's a, and you got to be called out in a balanced way. You know, it's got to be, it has to be done in a way where the praise and the criticism are appropriate, you know, and I think that they're appropriate and healthy in the way that they're done so that you can deliver a balanced individual, help a person become a balanced individual in terms of how they look at the highs and lows of their life. And when, and that's really the biggest thing with that. So to end the show, we've got a, you know, we've got a few minutes left here. I'm wondering if you could give me, you know, a couple of players who are young NFL players that you are really bullish about that haven't broken out yet.
Well, I think the first on the list for me, a guy who I think has untapped potential still and the upside to be maybe the best at his position, if not the best, one of the two or three best, is O.J. Howard in Tampa Bay. I think he has the just the well-rounded game as a tight end, both in the run game and as a playmaking receiver that now Bruce Arians there and maybe a more, you know, it's funny we talk about players that kind of have that aha moment. Jameis Winston, maybe things are finally going to click for him to take total control of that gig and that franchise, really. You know, he likes going to the tight ends, and I think O.J. Howard is in a prime position to really finally be the guy that everyone expected he would coming out in the draft a couple years ago. I think he's definitely one I would circle. And another one who I think, you know, maybe this is kind of a cheap answer because he kind of already had his breakout, you know, five game run last year, but it's Derrick Henry with the Titans. I think Derrick Henry has, you know, we talked about Tyreek Hill having a rare, almost generational trait with his speed. Now, Derrick Henry is a freak of nature that we haven't seen many guys like him before him, and we still haven't seen any prospects coming out in the last couple of years that come even close to looking the way he looks. And in today's NFL, where tackling has become somewhat of a lost art, when you have a 255-pound, 4'4 guy who has more wiggle than people give him credit for, you have a potential 2,000-yard rusher on your hands, Matt. And I know that sounds really lofty, but I go back to the Ravens teams when Jamal Lewis was a 2,000-yard guy, and he had such a unique body type, like the human bowling ball, where he was a 4'3 guy, I think, and he was a beast. And he the main reason why he ended up with a 2,000-yard season is he couldn't tackle him. Right? I mean, it sounds so elementary, but you couldn't tackle him. And Derrick Henry, we saw just a sneak peek of what this guy can be. If he is a 20 to 25 carry a game guy, I think the Titans have an offense that is not explosive. It's going to be ground and pound. Marcus Mariota and the receivers they have there are not going to be the kind of offense that's going to throw the ball all over the field. So they're going to be first down Derrick Henry, second down Derrick Henry, maybe even third down and two Derrick Henry. And if he gets enough touches, I think he'll be the NFL's leading rusher in 2019.
Love it. Love it. So who are some rookies from this class that you love in terms of team fit?
Like, I start with my Bears, right? David Montgomery. You know, you and I talked about David Montgomery on a podcast a couple weeks ago before the draft. And I said he was my number one running back in the draft. I thought he had a miniature version of a Jamal Anderson from the Dirty Bird days in Atlanta with his contact balance, his ability to change directions at 222 pounds, I think he is, just a stop-and-go ability. I think David Montgomery is the perfect fit for what the Bears are looking to do. Plus, he's got some pretty high-level traits, and he was the only running back in this year's class that I thought had at least one elite trait, and that's his ability to maintain balance through contact. So I think he's going to be a perfect fit. I love Devin Bush in Pittsburgh. You know, I think he's going to bring back the old school Steelers physical, intimidating style of play at linebacker. And I also love Marquise Brown in Baltimore. Assuming that his foot injury is okay and he can get back to full speed, you know, you want playground football players with the Ravens because you have a playground quarterback who's going to keep plays alive a lot longer than the average quarterback. And if he learns to keep plays alive this year behind the line of scrimmage instead of just taking off and running, you give a guy like Marquise Brown an extra 1 or 2 seconds to separate from a defensive back, game over. So I think pairing those two together is going to be really, really fun to watch. So I like those three guys pretty much.
Awesome. So what's a fit that concerns you?
I would say Rashawn Gary in Green Bay. I was a little taken back by the fact that they took him at number 12 overall. Not that he's not a top 15 player in the class, but I think they're playing him an outside linebacker in rookie minicamp. He's one of these guys that I think looks like Tarzan, plays like Jane. I don't know if he's going to be long for that role. I know he's wearing Clay Matthews' old number 52. I just don't see him being that kind of a high-impact pass rusher coming off the edge. It's going to be really interesting. He's one of these five-star kids, right? One of these guys that were told he's the best from day one. His college career at Michigan was very underwhelming. And to suddenly be an outside linebacker in the NFL, I mean, unless they shifted him from the last reports that I've read, I don't see it. I don't see how he's going to be set up for success in that role. And I also thought that the Texans reached on Titus Howard in the first round of offensive tackle. And it's not because Titus Howard isn't a good prospect, but I think the dangerous situation that they've put him in is he's a first round pick. He's going to be expected to start from day one and essentially be Deshaun Watson's best offensive lineman. And while I think maybe 2 or 3 years from now, he could be that guy, to expect him in 2019 to be a bookend tackle who can stop or at least protect Deshaun Watson from some of the league's best pass rushers, there's going to be a lot of growing pains there, and there's not a long learning curve, or I shouldn't say learning curve. There's not a lot of patience for offensive tackles to get it right, because one bad rep can end your season because Deshaun Watson doesn't get up. So I think it's going to put a lot of unnecessary pressure on a guy that, if he was a second round pick, would have been given a little more time to grow.
Listen, this was an excellent conversation, Brian, and I appreciate you being on this. I really, especially, you know, the agent conversation and the scouting talk, which is definitely in our wheelhouses in terms of talking about even beyond the players, but how they're evaluated and what goes on with it. And for everyone out there who enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, please follow Brian at Brian Perez, BryanPerez NFL. That's at Twitter. You can find his work at BearsWire.com and With the First Pick. Brian, thanks so much.
Matt, pleasure is all mine, man. Thank you.
Hey, great. And folks, thank you for listening. You know, as I've mentioned over the past few weeks, the RSP post-draft is available for download. So you can get that at mattwaldman.com. And when you get that, you also get the pre-draft and you get put onto the newsletter that comes out monthly from June through December that even re-ranks the past three rookie classes of players in the RSP post-draft that's out now, as well as at the end of August, as well as in November. So thanks again for listening, and you guys have a good week.